The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 9th, 2017. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible collusion between President Donald Trump's campaign and the Russian government during the 2016 U.S. election has been a mainstay in political discourse since Mueller's appointment in May. To contribute to that discussion, last week, Benjamin Wittes spoke at the International Student House about the special counsel investigation and the complications of investigating the president. He discussed the likely scope of Mueller's inquiry, the strategies a special counsel might use when investigating, different mechanisms for removing a president, and answered audience questions on a range of topics. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 246, Investigating the President.
Let me begin by asking you about the article, though, that you co-wrote yesterday, It's Time Congress Needs to Open a Formal Impeachment Inquiry. It makes, I think, a very solid case that now is indeed the time for Congress to start looking at this, but Congress, as we know, is controlled by the Republicans. What would it take for the House Judiciary Committee to actually be able to start considering impeachment against Donald Trump? Does Paul Ryan, the Speaker, have to request it, or can they somehow do it on their own?
So to give you an idea of how far the House Judiciary Committee is from a formal impeachment inquiry of the type that Jane Chung and I suggested, they actually recently did report out a resolution calling for an investigation. And the subject of the investigation that they called for an inquiry of was Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton's emails. That's actually not a joke. The article that Jane and I wrote was not an article about the political plausibility. It was about the merits of the question. And if the question is the analytical one, are they likely to do that? The answer is no. If the question is the analytical one, what would it take for them to do it? I don't know the answer to that question. One thing the last couple of years has taught me is that people should spend a lot less time doing predictions, and that includes me. And understanding the present is really hard enough. I'm actually not going to try, maybe ever again, to predict the future. Just the present is a difficult
enough analytical task.
Just procedurally, though, does Paul Ryan have to request it, or could the committee on its own?
So traditionally, the House of Representatives would pass a resolution authorizing the inquiry. But I think if the House Judiciary Committee chairman wanted to do it, there'd really be nothing to stop him, as it is, from holding hearings on a proposed set of articles of impeachment, or even just holding hearings on the underlying conduct that might give rise to it. So the bar that exists to what Jane and I were suggesting is not in any sense a procedural bar. It's a political will bar, and that is a debilitating one, but it's not that there needs to be some great authority that doesn't currently exist.
Okay. The case you made, I thought, was quite good. You said there was a target-rich environment against President Trump, but you focused on three areas. So I'll let you talk about each of them briefly. Abuses of power, failures of moral leadership, and abandonment of the basic duties of his office.
I mean, notice a few things. One is that those three areas do not track with any known federal crimes. And there's a real tendency when we talk about impeachment to think about it in terms of, well, did he commit a crime, and is that crime an impeachable offense? We're conditioned to think about it that way because we, believe, as people who are used to a certain set of criminal processes, that you don't get punished for things that aren't part of the criminal law. And that's not the way impeachment works. So there are certain crimes that are so de minimisly unimportant that you would never dream of impeaching a president for them. So one actual real-life example of this, of course, is that the president of the United States, three presidents ago, was in fact impeached for perjury and obstruction of justice in connection with both his testimony and other people's testimony in the Paula Jones civil lawsuit, and his grand jury testimony later in connection with that. And the Senate decided that this was actually not worth removing a president over. They didn't actually decide, interestingly, that he didn't do it, right? They didn't decide that it wasn't a criminal act. They didn't decide any of that stuff. They simply decided that it didn't kind of rise to the level at which you would actually want to remove a president for. You can make the crimes more less serious, right, and no less criminal. For example, imagine, this Sebastian Gorka, who was recently relieved of his job at the White House, seems to have inadvertently tried to bring a firearm on an airplane. The president gave him a job anyway. And some of us thought that was sort of inappropriate. But imagine that that had been Donald Trump, who had tried to bring a gun on an airplane. Would you impeach the president over that? It's clearly illegal. It's clearly a criminal act. And the answer is, well, of course not, right? Conversely, there are certain offenses that the president can commit that are unambiguously not criminal and unambiguously impeachable. So the famous constitutional scholar who wrote about this during the Watergate era, Charles Black, colorfully used the example of a president who decided he wasn't going to do any of the duties of president anymore because he wanted to move to Saudi Arabia so he could have four wives. And Black's point was, well, obviously that's not a criminal offense. There's nothing illegal about any of that. And it, obviously that would have to be an impeachable offense, right? And so the key point to understand about impeachable offenses is that they overlap significantly with the criminal code. Many, many criminal offenses are impeachable offenses. But they are not coextensive with the criminal code. There are a lot of things in the criminal code that are not going to, you're not going to impeach a president over, and there are many things outside the criminal code that you might. Now, the 7 months of the Trump administration have taught me that that latter list is extremely long, okay? And the number of things, and you quoted my phrase, the target-rich environment here, the number of acts and combinations of acts that the president has committed that I think a Congress that was actually thinking about the oath of office that they have taken to preserve and protect the Constitution, that they would be thinking of in light of the impeachment clauses is a rather long list. Now, because I'm not thinking about criminal acts and the sort of specific provisions of the criminal code, I tried to group them into sort of categories. And I want to start by flagging a category that I left out. We did not include the conflicts of interest issues, the emoluments clause issues. Now, these have gotten a great deal of attention. And Jane and I talked about them at quite a bit of length, and I actually think they're very serious issues. But I also don't think that they constitute an impeachable offense at this time. And the reason for that is that Congress has other remedies to deal with them. You know, if Congress wants the president to disclose his tax return, they can pass a law that says you have to disclose your tax return. If they don't want Ivanka and Jared and people who are, you know, close in blood or in relation to the president serving at his side, these are matters that you can legislate. As a real important matter of principle, I don't really believe that Congress should be using the impeachment power to, in the first instance. You have to exhaust other remedies that exist to you as the legislature before this is plausibly an appropriate area. And so the question that we asked ourselves is, okay, what are the big baskets of issues where Congress really doesn't have a remedy? And the conduct is egregious, and in which a reasonable person looking at this conduct would say this person is not merely unfit to be in office, because that's actually, as an initial matter, something that the voters got to decide, and they actually decided that people like me who've been arguing that for, you know, 2 years now are wrong. So it's not merely that he's unfit for office, but that the acts he has committed while in office don't merely render him unfit, they render him dangerous to democratic governance. So even so limited, it turns out to be quite a target-rich environment. And as you say, we identified kind of three broad areas. The first, and by far in my opinion the most important, is the abuses of power. Now, people want to frame this as obstruction of justice. One of the abuses of power is a set of activities that looks a lot like obstruction of justice. I will actually perfectly willing to leave it to Bob Mueller to decide whether it does or doesn't meet the formal legal definition of the elements of any of several obstruction of justice statutes. My suspicion is it may or may not. And I think you can't actually know the answer to that question without studying very closely a set of evidence that we don't have access to about what was going on in the president's head in the relevant period of time. Bob Mueller has some ability to investigate that. I don't. The question from my point of view is a president who interacts with his law enforcement apparatus on the basis on which Donald Trump began to, even before he took office, his initial meeting with Jim Comey was an appalling spectacle. So appalling that Comey walked out of that meeting and immediately wrote a memo. And when asked by the Senate Intelligence Committee why did he write a memo, he said, because of the nature of the person. That's an astonishing thing for him to have said. Through the firing, through the attacks on the threatened firings of Sessions, of Rosenstein, and of Mueller himself, through the boasting that this had something to do with the Russia investigation. This is a very long pattern of activity, and to me the question is, does that activity constitute an abuse of power? I think asking that question also answers that. There's a lot of other abuses of power that we could, you know, time limits. I'm happy to dwell on this as long as you guys want in the Q&A. But let's move on. The second area, so this is a tough area, is what I call gross moral lapses. Now, you can't impeach the president because you decide he's a slimeball. We knew that when we elected him, right? That's the classic overturning of an election. The question is, on the other hand, so let's take an example we flirt with in the article. The president has attacked the press in a fashion that some people, and I'm one of them, regard as kind of ginning up of hatred and scary stuff against members of the media. Imagine he did that to the nth that has actively called on people to attack reporters. He's gotten pretty close to that in a couple of instances. Well, let's say he did it explicitly. And let's say that a reporter actually got killed. And let's say that Donald Trump then showed up at that person's funeral and spat on his grave. Would anybody doubt that this degree of moral failing put us in the land of impeachment? I think the answer to that is no. And once you say that, you say, well, no, there's nothing criminal there, right? There's nothing, this is just how disgusting a human being do you have to be, right? And the question is, how close to that line are we? There's some line. I don't know what the answer to that question is. I feel differently about it after Charlottesville than I did before Charlottesville. Well, before Charlottesville, it was in my head, you know, kind of, how disgusting a human being could, before that alone becomes, you know, a basis. Now I think we're somewhere where we need to be thinking about that line. That's what an impeachment inquiry is for. Third category is abandonment of the office. So I started, Jane and I started thinking about this because of Black's what if he just decided to move to Saudi Arabia. That's the ultimate abandonment of the office, right? Not necessarily Saudi Arabia, but I just don't feel like being president anymore. I'm going to spend all my time in the White House bowling alley. There is a White House
bowling alley. We're at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah. I'm going to spend all my time at Mar-a-Lago eating chocolate cake. I want to cite two data points on this. I don't think we're at the point where you would impeach him alone for abandonment, but I do think he's raising a question about abandonment. The first is just the number of executive branch offices that are unfilled. Some of them, they've actually said, we don't want to fill them. How long do you have to not staff the executive branch before you can actually be said to be not doing the job of president? Again, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it is a question. The second is, I don't know how many of you read Dan Dresner's excellent blog of the Washington, but Dresner has been engaged in an interesting project of late, which is that every time a member of the senior staff of the White House or a cabinet officer or somebody in the president's party and very important talks about the president, managing the president the way you would talk about dealing with a toddler, he tweets, I'll believe the president has, you know, that Donald Trump is growing into the presidency when his staff stops talking about him as though he were a toddler. And he tweets a link to the article, and he adds it to this list. Now, this list now has 78 elements. That's 78 separate times that his staff has talked about him in a fashion that is the way you would talk about a very young child. I think when you put those various things together, you know, one scary thing is that Donald Trump doesn't show up for work and doesn't do the job. In many ways, the scarier thing is when he does show up. And when you're talking about that combination of scary stuff, you have to ask the question, is this person actually capable of doing the job? And that raises an abandonment question. So broadly speaking, those are the three baskets.
There are a lot of rumors, stories that one hears that the generals who work for Trump, Kelly, his chief of staff, Mattis, the defense secretary, McMaster, the national security advisor, are essentially running the show, or at least the national security, key national security aspects of the show, and that Trump is not really in charge of a lot of what a president would typically be in charge of. Do you have any sense of that, and does that constitute abandonment in a way?
Well, so there's an element of that that's clearly true. There's an element of that that's structurally and definitionally untrue. And then there's an element of it that's just kind of a head-scratcher, and you kind of, we won't know until that somebody writes the history and interviews all these people in depth. The element of it that's clearly true is that the president has clearly delegated a great deal to General Mattis, and Mattis seems, in the broad scheme of things, to get what he wants. And the evidence of that is that of all the crazy things that have happened
in this administration.
With the solitary exception of a White House tweet, a presidential tweet about transgender military people, none of them has involved the U.S. military. And the only conceivable explanation for that is that Mattis actually is running the Defense Department, which, to anybody who's sort of dealt with Jim Mattis over the years, I mean, is not surprising. He's somebody who would walk in and would not sit around while being, you know, he's obviously had to give up a certain degree of dignity for that. But he's clearly actually running his department in a way that I think it is also clear that the National Security Council is being run in a professional fashion now, in contrast to the insanity that it was under the previous leadership. And it's probably also true, I think, you know, that a bunch of improved staff-level decisions have happened since General Kelly took over for Priebus. The sense in which it is structurally and definitionally untrue is that the president is the president. And when the president, if the president allows these people to run things, it is by allowance that he is doing that. It's not that there's some palace coup and he's been locked in the basement. It's that he's delegated things to them. And that may be the limited signs of wisdom that we've seen from him, that he's been capable of doing that, and he's migrated to a more competent staff. But the ultimate evidence is that nobody controls him. And the executive branch in our system is a unitary actor. Now, this is the least unitary executive branch that I hope we will ever see in our lifetimes. But at the end of the day, the president is still the president, and there's no gainsaying that.
I have a couple more quick questions before I open to the audience. You filed a suit recently. Who did you sue? It had something to do, I believe, because you're alleging that President Trump has lied before Congress when he said, I think, that most of the terrorist acts in this country were committed by foreigners or foreign-born. Yeah. Who have you actually sued, and where does that stand?
So the background here is that the president went before a joint session of Congress in February. The quasi-State of the Union that the president gives his first year in office. And he made an astonishing comment that got very little attention at the time, but that bothered me. And the comment was that according to Justice Department data, the overwhelming majority of people convicted of terrorist acts in the United States since 9/11 came here from abroad. And I believe that this was a compound lie. First of all, that I don't believe it's true that the overwhelming majority or even the majority of terrorist acts are committed by people who came here from abroad. And I believe that the only way that you could find such a number is to exclude all of what the Justice Department calls domestic terrorism, which is to say the department distinguishes between international terrorism and domestic terrorism. The distinction being that international terrorism is conducted by foreign designated terrorist organizations. And there are good if complicated reasons why the Justice Department makes this distinction. But the second thing, that the part of this that really bothered me was not merely that he was committing a kind of a libel against immigrants, but that he was also, I'm almost certain, lying about the Justice Department. There is no such Justice Department data that I'm aware of, and I'm the sort of person who would be aware of that data. And I believe that the men and women of the Justice Department, who, you know, I think very highly of as a group, actually don't even keep such data about where people were born who commit terrorist acts or commit terrorist-related crimes. And so I asked one of my student contributors to Lawfare, a woman named Nora Ellingson, who is a former FBI counterterrorism analyst. She's now a law student. And I asked her to reality check me on this and spend some time going through the data such as that they were available. And she and another law student, Lisa Daniels, spent a long time on this. And their findings were consistent with my instincts, not with the president's statement. And they published a lengthy piece on Lawfare, which I urge you all to read. And in the wake of that piece, I kind of got angry. And I was kind of angry before the piece, but I got angrier. You know,
he gets angry a lot. You should follow his Twitter feed.
The president shouldn't be lying about immigrants. And he shouldn't be lying about data that he has access to. And there's just sort of two levels at which that is a very offensive thing for him to have done. And he shouldn't be standing in the well of the House talking to a joint session of Congress and making representations about factual matters that are politically sensitive and that involve real people's lives that aren't true and aren't defensible. And so I submitted a FOIA request to the Justice Department for any such data and for any correspondence with the White House made in support of or evaluating that line of the president's speech. And when the Justice Department didn't respond in a timely fashion, I sued them. This is the first lawsuit I've ever filed in my life. And by the way, I am confident that there is not a groundswell of anger at me among my many friends at the Justice Department for having filed this lawsuit. I wrote a little Lawfare post about it the day I filed it called The Friendliest Lawsuit Ever Filed Against the Justice Department. And I think, you know, I would settle it tomorrow on the basis of a clear statement from the Justice Department that no such data exists and no such correspondence exists.
Where does it stand in the scheme of things?
The Justice Department has yet to respond to the complaint. They will, I'm sure, as they should, defend the litigation aggressively. I really think at the end of the day, all they need to do is say that the data that I've requested don't exist.
Okay. I'm going to open it up, but one last thing. Those of you who follow Benjamin Wittes, and it's at Benjamin Wittes right, on Twitter, whenever there's a new development in the case against Trump, you have these sort of videos, GIFs, I don't know, of tiny cannons going boom and blowing up tomatoes and marshmallows and falling off decks and patios. And I just wonder, what is the meaning of the baby cannon? And why is that your signature now for Lawfare?
Well, I've always kept baby cannon off of Lawfare because Lawfare has a certain dignity and has always stood for a certain seriousness. I, on the other hand, have a no dignity, and I'm not above outrageous publicity stunts. Baby cannon was an accident. So the story.
Somebody sent it to you? Or?
No. The story of baby cannon. So a number of months ago, when I was in the midst of the aftermath of Comey's firing, and which. I, for reasons really having to do with the fact everybody thinks, which is not true, that Jim was routing information through
you, yes.
And this actually made it into a Senate hearing when Senator Collins asked him whether a story had been through me, and he said no, because it wasn't. But I was actually, the reason I was aware of this was that reporters kept calling me and asking me questions, and so I knew what they were working on.
Right.
And as their stories would start getting close to coming out, I would tweet, tick, 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 which was simply meant to give people a heads up that, hey, something's going to happen, you might want to stick by your computer. It's, and I never imagined that, you know, I had, it wasn't that many Twitter followers, so it was a way of communicating mostly to reporters who follow me, hey, something's about to break, you know, and I never meant it to become a sort of mass thing. And then once you're ticking the sound of like something getting ready to blow up, then when it blows up, you need something to represent the boom. So first, I would just tweet, boom. But then I had this little miniature cannon that just happened to have it. It actually worked. And my son and I had...
How old is your son?
He's 16. And we had happened to have gone out in the backyard and shot a can of Dr. Brown's cherry soda. And I happened to have this great video of it. And so I separated the video of the fuse burning from the video of the cannon attacking the poor can of cherry soda. And when I tweeted tick, 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 I played the video of the cannon fuse going down. And then when I did the boom, I did the other one. So unbeknownst to me, this actually was going to have a lot of resonance.
It's become a meme, I believe.
It's become a kind of a thing. And for complicated reasons, I decided to stop the tick, tick, ticking. But the day I stopped the tick, tick, ticking and said that I had done that, and this was the part that just kind of came out of nowhere, Rachel Maddow did a big, long monologue about tick, 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 and boom, in which she showed repeated videos of baby cannon going boom. And the thing took on a life of its own.
There
and now I feel an obligation to keep the baby cannons going. People
send you videos and things?
People have gone out and bought baby cannons and they send me the videos. People are very, and there's a weird psychological attachment that a lot of people, including me, have developed to these two little cannons as kind of emblems of things that herald major stories. And the serious side of it is that, you know, I do use it as a way of telling people what are stories you should take seriously, what are things that actually represent serious developments. And there's a lot of, pardon me, bullshit out there. And there are people who have made made real names for themselves by stoking people's anxieties and pretending that what they're doing is journalism, pretending what they're doing is speaking for people inside government. And a lot of them are charlatans. And the serious side of this is, you know, I want a way to distinguish between those people and people who are doing, you know, very dedicated, very careful, very energetic, sustained reporting on matters that are, you know, democratically important. And, you know, there are journalists who, and I don't want to spend a lot of time lecturing people about it, you know, though I've done a little bit of that. But just having a mechanism that says, okay, this is, you know, the K that, or the OU that goes on the food that says this has, you know, Wittes thinks this is, you know, valuable. And that's kind of what the baby cannon has become. And, you know, people who don't find that a useful rubric should, you know, follow a different Twitter feed.
All right. You've all been very patient. So we are recording this for a podcast. So if you have a question, migrate over to that side of the room and say your name, if you like, and ask a question. So who wants to be first? Here we go. Please.
You believe he lied before Congress that the majority of terrorist acts since 9/11 are committed by people from overseas, and you said, you know, essentially they weren't. Are you including things like, well, for example, in Charlottesville, we saw a great number of armed, heavily armed men in camouflage militias coming to presumably guard. Are you counting the militia movement, constitutional sheriff, which includes, for example, Arpaio and Clark, those movements that have committed Bunkerville, Malheur?
So it's a great question. Here's the general answer. Those, to the extent that those groups engage in violence, the acts of violence are the government would consider domestic terrorism. If you include, at least in the public data, if you include domestic terrorism, the percentage of terrorist acts that are committed by people who come from abroad is quite small, because domestic terrorism is actually a larger category of crime than international terrorism. I believe, I don't know what the thinking, if there was any thinking, that went into that presidential statement. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. So I don't know what they're including or what they're not. If they're not including that, then that is a very serious problem, because those groups, I don't want to, you know, domestic terrorism, particularly in the sort of white supremacist department, is a big part of the terrorism problem. And Charlottesville is an example of that. It's not the only example, but it's a significant example. And so if you're defining terrorism as terrorism committed by people from abroad, then yeah, a majority of those acts are committed by people from abroad. But that's not a useful thing. And it's,
I'm not even sure if that's the case. You know, the George Washington University program on extremism tracks all of this. And they actually have shown that, I think, even if you talk about so-called, you know, Islamist-related terrorism, that the majority of those acts are committed by people born in this country or converted to Islam.
So when we ran the data since 9/11, and this mm-hmm. was what Nora and Lisa found, mm-hmm. that it was literally true that the majority of terrorism or terrorism-related crimes were committed by people who'd come here from abroad, to the extent that they could identify the international cases. Except that a substantial group of those cases of people who'd come here from abroad were actually extradited here to face trial for things that they'd done elsewhere.
Okay.
And so the answer is, no matter how you slice it, based on the public data, the president's statement is extremely deceptive. The question is whether there's anything, any data that he had access to in the first month of his presidency that I don't have access to as a private citizen. I submit that the answer to that question is very likely no. I think that the administration was not actually sufficiently organized to get whatever data it might have had access to, and I think he just made it up. That said, I don't know. That's why I submitted the FOIA request, and when they didn't answer it, that's why I sued them.
I'm interested in knowing a little bit about the Mueller special investigation process and sort of what is the timeline for that. I've been tracking some of the news about subpoenas of certain documents or financial records. Could you explain those steps and sort of where we are in the process and what we can expect in the coming year?
Okay. So the answer to your question, can you explain, is no. Because, and here's, but let me take that a step further. Anybody who purports to explain what's going on is talking out of an orifice other than their mouths. Because the nature of an investigation like Mueller's is that it should be a black box in terms of information disclosure. The term straight arrow was like invented to describe Bob Mueller, okay? That's like the coiner of the term was thinking of him. And this is not an investigation that's gonna leak. This is an investigation that is, you're going to find out what they're really about when they start bringing cases and when they start saying things in public. So I'm not going to be the one who pretends to know what's going on.
We do know about subpoenas and things.
Right. Here's what we can say responsibly based on the public record. There is an active investigation. The investigation has criminal element, a number of different criminal elements. that it's investigating. It has a sitting grand jury in Washington. That grand jury has issued a number of subpoenas, including today there was a report that it had issued subpoenas to Paul Manafort's lawyers, which is a really interesting, former lawyers. It's a very interesting development. It is clearly investigating whether the president committed obstruction of justice in the pattern of activity that I described earlier with respect to his interactions with his law enforcement apparatus. It is also has a counterintelligence element. Now, people do not understand the difference between a counterintelligence investigation and a criminal investigation. That difference is important. They operate on different legal authorities. They have different purposes. And they sometimes interact and sometimes don't. The investigation, so the counterintelligence component is clearly investigating the Russian intervention and active measures with respect to the election last year and possible U.S.-based coordination or collaboration with that, including presumably by people associated with the Trump campaign. Finally, it is very clear that that investigation is looking quite hard at certain underlying financial transactions that the Trump organization and people associated with it and connected with it have engaged in abroad and probably domestically as well. There are two people, Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn, who clearly have a great deal of problems before this investigation. There may be others. And I think that is, broadly speaking, what you can say responsibly. There's a lot else that you can speculate based on those, but I think that's pretty much what the public record will give you for the taking. Now, what is the timeline? So the answer to that question is very simple. There is no timeline. There is never a timeline. The Lawrence Walsh investigation of Iran-Contra went on for, I think, about 7 years. The Ken Starr investigation was similarly lengthy. It was a very long process. And the reason these investigations take forever is a few discrete things. One is complex white-collar criminal investigations take a long time. That's the underlying dynamic. The second dynamic is that once you indict somebody, the process of litigation takes a very long time. It's not like you indict somebody and then you're done, right? You indict somebody and then you have pretrial litigation, then you have a long trial, then you have appeals. You can't shut down the investigation until all of this is done. And then the final reason is that, and this is a quirk of these political investigations, which is that, in a normal investigative context, certain people have a very strong incentive to cooperate. And maybe the underlying target of the investigation has a reason to cooperate. Maybe the person at the top of the pyramid doesn't, but the company that he works for wants to resolve the thing so that they can get on with life, right? In these investigations, the president never has an interest in cooperating, unless he's completely innocent, because it is better to posture yourself as the victimized target of a witch hunt. This is not unique to Donald Trump, by the way. This is exactly what Bill Clinton did. And it's what you do in this situation. Because the president has, I can talk for hours about this, and I'm not going to. The president has a lot of tools when he's being investigated that normal criminal defendants don't have. For example, the ability to fire the prosecutor, right? The ability to pardon all the witnesses. Normal criminal defendants don't get that. But he also has certain liabilities and vulnerabilities that other criminal defendants don't have. For example, if you're being charged with murdering somebody in the course of a robbery, normal, typical defense in that situation is, yeah, I was there at the robbery. I was robbing a liquor store, but I had nothing to do with the murder. I was gone by the time that happened. Right? The president can't make that argument. Because there are certain defenses that you use that are so politically damaging, even if they're true, right, especially if they're true, that you can't make them. And so the result is you have to deny everything, even when it's true. And you have to hold that line for as long as you possibly can. And that will drag it out. So don't think about it in terms of a timeline. That's a rabbit hole you will never get out of. It's an extended state of affairs that will outlast the Trump presidency. This, whether the Trump presidency is a 1 year more, 3 years more, and he gets voted out after his first term, or whether he's in office the whole for 8 years, this investigation will outlast him.
Thanks for everything you do, first of all. You mentioned the number of the saturation on social media of charlatans who are peddling false information, non-information, complete absence of fact. And I was wondering, as someone who's a part of the journalism / governmental sphere, do you have any advice for us laypersons that are trying to exist in this world, where this post-facts world, and we're constantly frustrated by all of the misinformation, disinformation floating around out there? How can we combat that?
So it's a really important question. Let me give you an example of this that has been floating around for a long time now. It's been weeks and weeks and weeks, months. There's this meme, and probably some of you know of it, but a lot of people believe this, that there is a huge Washington Post story about wiretaps that they have that will blow up the Trump presidency, and they've been holding it at the request of Bob Mueller. Right? So those of you who spend time on Twitter, this is going around. I want to submit that in an environment in which people, the news organizations are ferociously competitive with one another about getting information out there. The competition is really fierce. And you saw that this week where the New York Times or the Washington Post breaks a story Sunday night. They ran it on Sunday night. Like, what does that tell you? The New York Times follows up Monday midday with a significant incremental development in that. And within hours, the Washington Post comes back with another story. And then that evening, the Wall Street Journal comes back with an interview with one of the relevant players. So that gives you a sense of what the actual competitive environment looks like. In that context, does it really make sense to believe that the Washington Post is sitting on the ultimate bombshell because Bob Mueller asked them to sit on? Right? Now, when no reputable news organization is willing to go with information, there's a reason for that. Right? If the only place you're seeing monumentally important factual developments is in the Twitter feeds of people whose main claim to fame in life is that they have Twitter feeds that do such things, be skeptical of that. So let me give you I've tweeted about this, but let me give you an example about how a real reporter works, okay? Because this was a story I was very directly involved with. And let me just tell you about how the New York Times vetted it. When Michael Schmidt at the New York Times reported that the president had asked for a loyalty oath from Comey, this really shocked me. Not because I thought that Trump was morally above such things, but because I suddenly understood when I read this story a series of things that Jim had told me while he was in office that...
And you two are good friends.
We're friends. And I suddenly realized what a bunch of things meant that I hadn't understood entirely before. And so I picked up the phone and called Mike Schmidt and said, I've got more information for you. And the next day he came over to my office and we sat down, we had a long conversation, and he actually recorded that conversation, and you can listen to that conversation, or large swaths of it anyway, on the New York Times daily podcast, The Daily, which is a really good, by the way, podcast about reporting and how it works. And Mike did a long set of conversations. It was a long conversation. And I laid out a whole lot of information to him. And then he stuck a piece of paper in front of me and he said, draw Comey's office. Now, I have teased him about this, and he insists that he was not vetting me to see if I really knew what Jim's office looked like. But of course he was vetting me to see what if I knew what Jim's office looked like. And that's exactly what he should have been doing under those circumstances. Now, I gave him some stuff. If you look at the story that came out of this, there was some real new stuff in that story. Not so much about factual matters, but about what Jim was thinking in the relevant period of time. He did not run with that story for days. He was checking things. He was corroborating things that I said. He was figuring out what he could and could not responsibly say. Now, he knew I wasn't talking to anybody else, so he wasn't terribly afraid of losing the story. But I actually believe he would have behaved the same way if he wasn't that confident about it. And so I think the question you have to ask yourself whenever someone's asking you to believe something that's extraordinary is, what basis do I have to believe this person? Is this the sort of organization that I have confidence does its homework? Is this the sort of person who I have confidence does his or her homework? And if the answer to that question is no, it's fine, it's perfectly fine to wait till somebody else runs with it. Sometimes, by the way, the most extraordinary stories turn out to be corroborated within 10 minutes. And so, you know, the fact that something's too good to be true or too awful to be true doesn't mean it's not true, particularly these days. But if you have a sustained situation in which the reputable reporters are not reporting something, there's usually a reason for that. And it's very seldom that the intrepid citizen journalist has access to wildly better sources than does Carol Lenig at the Washington Post. You know, Carol, there's a reason she keeps breaking these stories. She's really good. She's been working law enforcement sources. I worked with her when we were at the Post together. She's been working sources for a long time. She knows who to talk to. She knows how to talk to them. She's going to do it better. And by the way, sometimes those institutions, their conservatism will cause them to get beat on something. And that's great, because the willingness to lose a story rather than be wrong is the thing that causes you not to be the person that reports that the Washington Post, over and over again, that the Washington Post has this bombshell story that it's going to break any moment now, except that Bob Mueller's asked them not to run it. It's the best I can do.
So with respect to two of the categories you've talked to, the moral vacuity and the abandonment, both of those could also be thought of as grounds under the 25th Amendment. And I wonder, we've heard Corker, we seem to have had Tillerson, we have a number of cabinet secretaries who seem on the verge of saying, this president is not only is he not hitting on all cylinders, he may not have cylinders. How do you see the interaction between impeachment and the 25th Amendment, which you could say is incapacity? And there is a sense, I think, in which people are wondering about capacity.
So it's a very profound question, and it's actually one that the gentleman to whom you just handed the microphone is actually doing, as we speak, a deep dive into the legislative history of the 25th Amendment in an attempt to explore that exact question. Again, there's a line drawing exercise here, because everybody agrees if the president showed up, say, at this, I don't know why I always use this example, but it's the one that always comes to mind. If he shows up at the State of the Union address naked and babbles obscenities in Latin, right? And, I'm sorry? He doesn't know Latin. Well, you would say he's speaking in tongues. We would all agree that is incapacity for the purposes of the 25th Amendment, right? And so there's some line of, shall we say, extreme eccentricity in behavior that you would say is cognizable under the 25th Amendment. That said, the 25th Amendment was written and passed with a very different situation in mind, which was, what if it was passed after the Kennedy assassination? And the concern was, what if Oswald had shot Kennedy and Kennedy had not died, but had just been in a coma? And the Constitution actually doesn't have an answer to that question in 1963, right? It's the president is president and Lyndon Johnson is vice president under those situations, and nobody under those circumstances has the authority to exercise the power of the presidency. So they're definitely thinking about physical incapacity, and physical incapacity is one of those things that's a little bit easier to define than mental incapacity, particularly when we voted for the guy knowing that he had some of these issues, right? And so what I would say is I'm much more comfortable in the impeachment department than I am in the 25th Amendment department, because in the impeachment department, I can say Donald Trump has done certain things since taking office that I consider warranting impeachment and potentially removal from the office of president. I can't say he's more incapacitated today than he was the day he was inaugurated, or for that matter, the day he was elected. And so I don't really know how to process, other than to say I agree with you. There's some degree of conduct of this sort that you would say, yeah, we're in 25th Amendment land. I don't know how to distinguish between that and, we voted for a nut knowing that he was a nut, so we get a nut as president, and that's called democracy.
I believe your colleague Susan Hennessy had a post about this on foreign policy recently as well. But you discussed kind of whether or not the executive branch could snap back to what we would consider normalcy, or whether this was a permanent weakening. And my question was, if you believe the executive branch can snap back, what kind of qualities or characters of the next person to hold office would be to lead that snap back? And do you think it's likely that we will elect such a
man? So I am a little bit agnostic on the question of whether Trump is cause or effect here. But he's clearly somewhat, in large part, cause. The question is whether he's also in small part effect. If you imagine a snapback where, all of these crazy stuff that he's done, the next president rebels against, whether a president of the left or a president of the right, the ideology doesn't matter, but somebody who will behave in a fashion that comports with our traditional sense of what presidential behavior is across all the range of areas that Trump has violated that. One of those is that he has to be prepared to fire people who don't do what he wants. And Trump is very is peculiar in this regard, because he presents himself as a tough guy. He's a tough negotiator. He wants to be really tough. And he's actually a complete pushover for staff that absolutely defy him. I mean, the Secretary of State the other day goes on national television on the Sunday talk show and is asked by Chris Wallace, what about the president's comments about Charlottesville? And he basically says, the president doesn't speak for me. The president speaks for himself. Now, in a normal executive branch, Rex Tillerson would be fired before he left the studio. That is not the way the executive branch is supposed to work. Now, maybe he did it not caring if he was going to be fired. But the remarkable thing about it is, first of all, he doesn't care if he's going to be fired. But secondly, that he wasn't fired. There wasn't even a discussion, in public anyway, about firing him. Let me give you another example that, to my mind, is more extraordinary. The acting head of the Drug Enforcement Agency, a minor federal law enforcement agency, right? Not the FBI, not somebody who's a household name, great American named Chuck Rosenberg. The president says, you know, in a public rally, you know, we should be easier about bashing heads when we arrest people. Don't cover their heads when you shove them into the police car. And Chuck Rosenberg writes an email to the entire DEA staff saying, that's not our values. We don't mistreat people that we've taken into custody. And by the way, it's our job to call out things that are wrong. Chuck Rosenberg is still in office. I could give you a list that would take the rest of the people just contradicting the president. If we're going to have a normal executive branch again, they can't do that. And I'm delighted that they do, because they're speaking for my values here. But I also think about the next president, and I think one of the things the next president is going to have to do is require that his senior staff actually represent his point of view, not say that he doesn't represent theirs, and that they actually follow orders or they lose their jobs. And that is a fascinating problem that the Trump presidency, all in the name of toughness, has created, that actually he's a total wuss about staff that contradict him.
Thank you guys for doing this. I love the setup that you just presented. I want to kind of follow up to that. It seems that President Trump is starting to alienate himself from his allies on the right, from the senators, from the congressmen, and from the staffers. If he continues to withdraw and become more alienated, he's not going to be able to accomplish much, but he still has power over the football. If he were to sense an end coming, what protections are protecting us from dealing with the consequences of that risk? Thank you.
My question, there's really two parts to it. The first one is, we live in a very unique political time. So what I think when I think about the Trump presidency and where things are headed is, what is the true inflection point that would cause the Republicans to act? And you talked earlier about obstruction, but is it the firing of the special prosecutor? Is it the return of a report that has charges other than something that is close to conspiracy to subvert an election? You know, what is the touch point, if you have a view on that? And the second part of it is, what does it take to get the country ready to hear something like that? Because I think that's a part that people don't understand. And as someone who's 51 and being 7 to 9 during Watergate, I can hear my parents saying what the country was ready for. So this one, I think, is going to shake people more than the prior. So I'd be interested in that.
Going back to your comments about Secretary of State Tillerson, so we have no tradition of resignation under protest. I know Cyrus Vance and the guys with former Yugoslavia, but basically people don't do that. They toe the line, as you say. Do you think this might start changing towards that?
Okay, so let's start with the football. The terrifying answer to that question is that there are no real protections. There's a reason the football follows the president around, and that is that we have sole command. And there are good reasons for sole command, but they do presume presidential sanity, which is a circumstance not wholly in evidence right now. The only real defense that we have is the willingness of officers not to carry out orders they believe to be illegal. And the circumstances in which a nuclear strike would be lawful are, limited as a general matter to circumstance of imminent threat. And so I would not bet the farm on that as security. And I think at the end of the day, if you want to tyrant-proof the executive branch, the only way to do it is not elect tyrants to run the executive branch. And if you want to make it insanity-proof, the only way to do that is not to elect insane people to it. The nuclear extreme is a real pointy end of that particular spear. I will say that the president has a partner in this problem, and that's Kim Jong-un. One thing to hope for is that our president behaves rationally. But it would be easier to hope for that if Kim Jong-un would stop firing missiles at the Pacific Ocean over sovereign countries that happen to have alliances with us. What would it take to get the Republicans in a different posture? This is precisely the type of predictive question that I no longer feel qualified to answer. A year ago, I would have ventured a confident sense of that, and I just don't want to do that anymore. As to resignation and protest, I have urged resignations and protest, and I really believe that a person of any personal dignity would not show up for work the day after the president talked about him the way the president talked about Jeff Sessions. I've joked that if Strobe Talbot, who's the president of Brookings, ever talks about me that way in public, I will not show up to work the next day. And I'm not really sure why it's that different if you're the Attorney General of the United States. That said, I do think some of these people have a sense that, they are the line between the president and terrible things happening. And in some of their cases, they're probably right. I think that's particularly true of General Mattis. And so I think you have to be very careful about whom you ask to resign in protest, and whom you respect the fact that they are, as my colleague Quinta Jurassic put it, that they are saving the city at some cost to their own soul, and that's a Machiavelli said that the prince has to love his city more than he loves his own soul, and I think for some of them, that is part of what's going on here, and we should all have a lot of respect for that. For some of them, that's what they're telling themselves is going on here, and we should probably have a lot less respect for that.
Well, thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating discussion. I highly recommend the Lawfare blog to those of you who are junkies when it comes to this kind of analysis. So thank you for coming to the International Student House. Now that you know what it is and where it is, I hope you will come back again.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Special thanks this week to the International Student House for allowing us to record the event. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yeelan. Thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.